Welcome back to OTR. Our guest this week is the lawyer who sued the governor to reopen sports across the state. His name is Peter Riddell. Our lead story, the governor has done just that starting Monday. On the OTR panel, Chad Livengood, Emily Lawler, and Abigail Sinsky. Sit in with us as we get the inside out, off the record.
Production of Off the Record is made possible in part by the following. Business Leaders for Michigan has a strategic plan to make Michigan a top 10 state in the nation for jobs, personal income, and a healthy economy. Learn more at michiganswroadtotop10.com. And now, this edition of Off the Record with Tim Skubick.
Welcome back to Off the Record, a Zoom edition, a busy week in our town with lots going on. Let's say good morning to our panel, if they will magically appear. Yes? No? There they
are.
Hello.
Morning.
Emily, Chad, Sinsky, nice to have you all on board on this wintry day. Of course, the lead story out of our town this week, everybody knows, was coming on Monday. Sports is back. The governor has made a decision. Here's what she told us this week.
Well, here's something you've not heard or seen in months. High school b-ball will be back on the court starting with practice on Monday, along with other winter sports. So says Governor Gretchen Whitmer, who is looking at improving COVID numbers in Michigan from her chief medical officer. The governor says those numbers justify her decision.
Detroit, Traverse City, and the Upper Peninsula are all at less than 150 cases per million people. Our test positivity rate is also declining and is now at 4.9%. That is the lowest it has been since mid-October. The percent of beds that are utilized by patients with COVID-19 is steadily declining as well and is now at 6.6%. So overall, I'm pleased.
Also pleased are those student athletes, their parents and coaches who sued the governor this week to open up sports sooner than February 21st, the governor's original date. The governor did change her mind, but she insists that the protest and gripes had zero impact on her decision.
I've been very clear throughout this crisis that we are going to follow the science, and that's what we have been doing. But as for, you know, events that have happened, that's not what drives decisions in my administration.
While persons applaud this sports decision, on the legislative front, there is no reason to applaud. That's because the governor and the Republican leaders are at odds over how to spend $5 billion in federal COVID aid. The governor fears if there's no agreement, other states will get a head start on stopping the virus. So are they at least talking?
Oh, yeah, there's all sorts of talks going on, Tim. That's precisely why this is so important, that these resources that have been given to us, we get them deployed so that we can keep this trajectory that we're on going and get back to normalcy as quickly as possible.
And while it may feel just a little bit normal with high school sports back on, the governor warns we're not totally normal yet.
All right, Chad, the question in town is, did she cave?
Well, she says that she didn't, but we don't know what is the factor that goes into these decision makings. What is the difference between this week and last week? Last week, there was 7% of COVID patients occupying 7% of hospital beds. This week is 6.5. Is there some magic number in between there and that half a percentage point? I'm not sure. But what is the difference between the bars reopening on Monday and waiting another week when she initially said it was going to be three more weeks of no contact for high school sports? So most people will look at this and say that she caved. But you know, we got to keep asking the governor, what is the actual metrics that we have to hit to open and close go back into the groundhog's hole.
Emily, what do you think?
Yeah, I think Chad's point is a good one. You know, the governor has consistently said that she's relying on science and metrics without exactly outlining what those might be. So, you know, there's not, some other states have established a pretty clear threshold, percentages, a formula of sorts for when things can open, when things would close. Michigan has not done that. So it's not exactly clear where a lot of these actions are rooted.
Abigail.
Yeah, Yeah, I think Emily brings up a good point that, you know, we've been asking about this for a while, and we've seen, you know, early on in the pandemic, we used to see modeling from the University of Michigan and hear more about those metrics. But recently, in conversations with reporters, the governor has defended her decision of being a little bit less than transparent about some of the metrics being used to make decisions like this one on winter contact sports, because she doesn't want to be wed to those numbers and that it hasn't worked out for some states. That's been her defense. But in terms of, you know, a situation like winter contact sports like this, I think the case of let them play, bringing up, you know, why should high schoolers be allowed to go to shopping malls or restaurants and not play sports? That is a really great question when we don't know the metrics that are being looked at to make these kinds of decisions.
So, Chad, the question is, the Republicans have been bellyaching for weeks for the governor to do something to reopen the economy, and she's done that now with the bars to a degree and the restaurants, and now the sports are back. Is she coming up with enough to get them to the table to negotiate a deal on this COVID money, which is sitting there right now?
Well, nobody's going to just let $5 billion not get spent. I mean, even the House Republican plan spends $3 billion up front, and then, or at least, and then some state aid as well, state surplus. But they're going to, I mean, yes, they're going to get to the table. We're going to get more action here next week when the governor rolls out her fiscal 22 budget year plan. So, and there'll be all kinds of new proposals, I imagine, that go along with that. And they'll add some new dynamics to this. And these things we will, you know, they usually get negotiated together, though. The urgency here is that there's money to spend, and there's an economy that is just kind of possibly teetering on the edge here in many ways. Let's not forget, I mean, yes, bars, restaurants reopened this week, but in December, there were 200,000 fewer restaurant hospitality workers in Michigan than the year before that. That is a job loss for a single industry that we haven't seen. We never even saw in one single foul swoop during the Great Recession in the 10-year, you know, single state recession that we suffered. So these are real suffering going on out there right now. And that's putting pressure on all sides here to get to the table.
Emily, the Michigan House this week passed their plan without input from the governor. Is that a forebearer of things to come? But she did tell us yesterday that there were lots of talks going on, as we heard in that soundbite. So are we to believe that these folks will get a compromise on this?
I think Chad's right that I don't think anyone could really afford politically to just let these dollars sit on the table or give them back to the feds in any way. Obviously, Michigan could use this money for some of our COVID recovery efforts. But, you know, the chasm between the governor and the Republicans in the legislature right now is really about her control, right? So they both want to spend the money. The Republicans just want to shift some of that control to local governments in terms of opening and closing things like schools and sports. And I would say that that's been a goal of theirs for a long time. That's not really out of the blue. What's different is just that they're connecting it to the money at this point.
So, Abigail, the numbers that the governor's chief medical officer shared with us appear to be very good, but the X factor continues to be this variant, and this is a ticking time bomb, is it not?
Yeah, you know, we've heard, you know, it is kind of the classic case of what we've had throughout this entire pandemic, is we don't know a lot about these new variants or new factors of this pandemic when they first emerged. So we've heard constantly from the scientists and public health officials who study this, that this is a more contagious variant. And, you know, in places like Washtenaw County, where there's a new variant of COVID-19, they have something like 28 cases, Dr. Khaldun said yesterday, which is completely shuttered the University of Michigan Athletics Department. And they've, you know, asked their students to kind of have a, once again, lockdown for another 2 weeks and kind of shelter in place once more. So I don't know that we've seen the community spread, but that's kind of what the governor and Dr. J have been saying this entire time, that we don't know how many lives are saved, how many cases are stopped when you introduce new factors into the mix, like another COVID variant. So there's a lot of guesswork still.
All right, Chad, let's turn the page. Laura Cox versus Ron Weiser. This is some dirty laundry that we're going to be putting out here on Off the Record. The current Republican chair is accusing the former Republican chair of doing what?
Accusing Ron Weiser, a multimillionaire real estate mogul from Ann Arbor, of taking $200,000 of administrative funds. This is the corporate slush funds that both parties get to have, where corporations and unions can get, and individuals can give unlimited amount of money, and they can use it for any kind of non-election earning type purpose, pay consultants. It's a very much a consultant's cash fund. And what Laura Cox is alleging is that Ron Weiser took $200,000 and paid it to Shelby Township Clerk Stan Grott to get him to drop out of the 2018 Secretary of State's primary against Mary Tedder Lang, and so that she could run unopposed, and they would have at least one woman on the ballot against the all-woman slate on the Democratic side. This is an explosive allegation. They say they had this investigated. They have this report compiled by some attorneys at Warner Norcross and Judd, and it essentially lays out that Grott got payments over a period of 7 or 8 months from the end of 2018, starting just after he dropped out of the race, just a week or two before the convention in 2018, August 2018. He got these payments all the way until just a few days before Laura Cox took office as the new chair in February of 2019. Ron Weiser is under fire. I wrote about how he's facing an 11th hour crisis right now in his bid to become sort of a third term as the chairman of the party, where he's supposed to, he was going to be a cakewalk election on Saturday in the virtual this virtual convention, but Laura Cox was never taken off the ballot. So Laura Cox has now declared herself back in, says she wants to be a temporary chair for a few months and then let the state party committee, this 110 member group, essentially pick a new chair themselves. I cannot see that going over with the grassroots activists of this party that are running this party. Of course, Weiser's candidacy also has gotten under fire because his co-chair is Michonne Maddock, the conservative political activist from Western Oakland County, who was at the rally spoke at a rally the day before the January 6th insurrection of the state of the U.S. Capitol. Pretty messy.
Emily, this is a potential political problem, not only from the standpoint of this inter-party feud going on, but now Jocelyn Benson, the Secretary of State, has gotten this complaint from Ms. Cox. And you could say that she might bump this up to the Attorney General. And now we have the Attorney General investigating the Republican Party. If that's a possibility, that's a story, isn't it?
Well, certainly that would be a story. And just seems sort of rare. I don't recall very many instances of, parties sort of turning against themselves to the extent that they're turning each other in, I guess, to the authorities or to the at least campaign finance authorities in this case. And it seems like, this party infighting, I think everyone kind of expected a tension between the more grassroots Trump side of the party versus Republicans who were sort of ready to move on from Trump. That is not the fight here, frankly. And 2 weeks ago, we might have thought it would be. Chad mentioned that Michonne Maddock is on the ticket with Ron Weiser, and that looked like a bit of a controversy a couple weeks ago. That is tame in comparison to what we're seeing now.
Well, we'll see how it works out this weekend. Either Mr. Weiser will be chair or not. And either way, we have a story. Now, we also have a story by calling in the attorney in town who sued the governor to reopen sports. And there he is. Peter, welcome to the program. How you doing?
Great. Thanks for having me, Tim.
So have you dropped your lawsuit?
We have not dropped our lawsuit yet. We can't drop our lawsuit until we need to see this February 7th interim guidance that is seemingly elusive. So The order refers to some guidance around testing and other measures that student athletes need to take in order to be able to compete, and we haven't seen it.
So if you read something in there that you don't like, you'll continue to sue her?
Well, we'll have to see what it is. And remember, Tim, we're actually not suing the governor on this one. We're actually suing the state health director who issued the order. So we have to see what is in that document before we make the final decision on whether we're going to dismiss the lawsuit or proceed.
Abigail?
Yeah, one of my questions is kind of about that interim guidance, really testing in this winter pilot program that we saw over 6,000 students testing 202 schools. There were 74 positive individuals, but as far as who's providing the test, is this going to be the High School Athletic Association? Is this going to be the state? Who's going to incur those costs? Have you had any conversations about that?
I've had no direct conversations about that whatsoever. I believe the legislature yesterday in one of their appropriations bills appropriated some dollars for this. And I think at the press conference, either Director Hertel or the governor alluded to that the state would provide the tests as they required them. But we haven't seen the specifics, which is part of the reason we can't dismiss the lawsuit yet.
Emily.
So, sort of a broad question here, but a lot of the flashpoints that we've seen around the governor's orders and then the MDHHS orders have been around economic constraints, right? We saw barbershops and gyms and restaurants all be, upset about some of the restrictions and closures. How did we land on high school sports as like the flashpoint of the coronavirus restrictions right now? What makes that so important to people?
So, you know, that's a fantastic question, Emily. In the last week, and I've only been working on this issue for about 13 days, I've talked to so many parents who are frankly frightened for the future of their children, their future's emotional and mental well-being. I think this one really cut home closer than any of those economic issues. There's this old adage that I've been told many times, never get between a mama bear and her cub. And in some respects, I think this prohibition on contact sports, indoor sports, really the state health department did that.
Peter, can you take us into your 13 days of talks with DHHS? Just what was behind it's okay to open the bars, as Emily noted, teenagers can walk freely and hang out in shopping malls, but they can't they can't play hockey and basketball and other contact sports, cheerleading too.
So Chad, you broke up on me a little bit there. So I'm gonna assume I know your question and just keep going. We had great talks up until the moment in time when we filed the lawsuit, and then our talks were exclusively with the state attorney general. I think this is a complicated issue, and I think, unfortunately, this was a bomb that was left on Director Hertel's desk by her predecessor. So, as we've alluded to in most of our filings and public statements, 38 other states are allowing these activities, including all of our surrounding states. As I think either Emily or Abigail alluded to, the testing regime in the fall, right, showed a 99.8% negativity rate. So the transmission among these high school at student athletes is really quite low. We think that, right, the governor and her team, as I've said in other settings, has had a fantastic goal and a laudable goal of reducing the transmission of COVID. The issue that many of our parents, student athletes, and administrators have is the unintended consequence of the mental health and emotional health of these student athletes.
But the nub of the governor's argument was she's about saving lives. Were you going to challenge that in a lawsuit?
We were not going to challenge a saving lives argument, right? We were going to challenge the issue of the right to education, the age discrimination of student athletes in high school versus those in college and the pros, and we were going to challenge the mechanism by which this order and the interim guidance was issued. And I keep using it in the past tense, Tim, but the lawsuit is still out there.
I understand. So you believe that the Whitmer administration overreacted to this by shutting down these sports. Is that a fair statement, Counselor?
I think that the original order prior to January 22nd, which allowed winter sports to begin resumption on February 1st, was fair and appropriate. Delaying it by 3 weeks without any reasonable explanation was unwarranted from the previous health director.
But what is your proof that the mental health of students is affected? It's speculation, is it not? The counsel for the attorney general might argue against you.
You know, we have a whole host of experts and parents that are willing to come in and testify if necessary on the mental health of the student athletes. I think the evidence is pretty overwhelming. And frankly, the governor's speaker at her press conference yesterday, the second doctor from, I think, IHA, confirmed everything we had been saying.
But there are others in the health community that have agreed with the governor all along up to this point. Is that not true as well?
Those others in the health community have agreed with the governor on COVID and have confirmed her singular goal of reducing COVID transmission.
Abigail.
You know, pending the resumption, or I guess beginning of winter contact sports on Monday, you noted the disparity between college and professional athletes in Michigan and high school athletes. But those programs, you know, when they have people test positive, they've shut down temporarily. And we've seen University of Michigan athletics halt, and 15 players tested positive a while ago at Michigan State as well. What kind of situation is the state going to be in now to halt or pause athletic seasons if there's outbreaks in smaller areas or just select locations of the state and not, you know, blanket statewide athletics?
Well, you know, I think the state public health code allows local health directors to do exactly what you've described. And I think the legislature, you know, one of the bills that they passed in the House this week allows just that. Local health directors, when there are outbreaks, to take the measures necessary to contain those outbreaks in those specific geographic areas. So we think it can be managed by existing law and should be.
Emily.
I guess part of that law that you brought up, though, would require those health directors, if the Senate passes a similar version, to use metrics set by the Michigan legislature. So in the case of a county like Washtenaw right now, which has 28 cases of this new variant, they wouldn't meet metrics to close anything down. What about cases like that?
So, you know, again, that's a bill that's passed the House. The governor's going to have an opportunity to sign it. So it wouldn't just be the legislature. It would be, you know, a bipartisan, bicameral process. So if those metrics aren't the right ones, you know, I think the governor and her team and other health experts would have an opportunity to weigh in before they are enacted.
Emily.
How much tension is there as you're, you know, talking to these parents about sort of the difference or the trade-off between academics and athletics? Because I've talked to, for instance, a Kent County health official who has outlined that they know through contact tracing that athletics have cost kids in classroom time. And then, of course, this fall we saw when athletics were opened that many school districts, even the ones who weren't allowing in-person classes, we're allowing in-person athletics. How do you balance that tension? And I mean, is athletics sort of becoming a North Star over academics at this point?
Yeah, I don't agree with that conclusion that athletics are becoming a North Star over academics. I think athletics are a pathway for many student athletes. They're an outlet for many student athletes. They're a way in which they learn some incredible skills, right? You know, teamwork, perseverance, and grit. So I think athletics have always been a key component of a public education in Michigan. And it's just, you know, it's unfortunate that we have this pandemic that requires us to kind of pick binary choices. There is a full complement of choices that we can pick in terms of how we engage athletics and academics. And so I kind of disagree with your conclusion that athletics have become kind of the North Star. I think they've always been a key component of public education in Michigan.
But
all right, Chad, we have 1 minute. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Should there ever be a time when school districts are offering in-person athletics but not academics?
Oh, that's a question I can't answer. It's a good one, though.
Peter, you noticed. Chad, we have 1 minute left before we do overtime with the counselor. Go ahead, Chad.
Peter, you've been in this town a long time. Philosophically, from a sort of policy-making standpoint, should legislators be putting things like metrics about reopening different types of businesses and just this kind of really finite detail? Should that be going into statute?
Oh, that's a really good question and a tough one, Chad. Right? I mean, you look back to the flu in 1918. We had a shutdown ordered by then Governor Albert Sleeper of approximately 21 days. The order that was issued by Director Hertel goes into effect through March 29th, 2020. We will have lived over a year in a variety of shutdown orders. So I think there needs to be a balance between the extraordinary power exercised by the executive branch here and the legislature's ability to put metrics into state law. And I think we've kind of gotten out of balance in that relationship. And I think it's really time for us to figure out a way to get back in balance. And frankly, I think Elizabeth Hertel is probably the best person suited as health director to do just that.
Counselor, we'll be back with overtime with you in a couple of seconds, so stay tuned. Before we put a top on this tonight, a little bit of a celebration in our town this week. Off the Record has celebrated, as of yesterday, 49 years on the air. And it is not true that Abraham Lincoln was our first guest. Go to WKAR.org for overtime with our counselor and our panel right after these close credits.
Production of Off the Record is made possible in part by the following. Business Leaders for Michigan has a strategic plan to make Michigan a top 10 state in the nation for jobs, personal income, and a healthy economy. Learn more at michigansroadtotop10.com. For more Off the Record, visit WKAR.org. Michigan Public Television stations have contributed to the production costs of Off the Record with Tim Skubick.